I didn't sleep with him because I wanted him. I slept with him because everything around me was closing in, and he was the only thing that seemed solid enough to lean on. That's the part people never understand. They want a clean beginning, desire, attraction, a spark, something that sounds like choice. What I had felt more like a calculation made under pressure, a quiet, desperate math problem where the answer kept coming back the same no matter how I ran it. I told myself it was temporary. I told myself I was being smart. I told myself I was taking control of a situation that was already tilted against me. I had watched what happened to women who didn't protect themselves, who trusted systems, who believed good work would be enough. I wasn't naive anymore. At first it worked. Doors stopped slamming, emails got answered, my name stopped floating around in rooms I wasn't invited into. I felt safer, not respected, not valued, just safer. And then he started asking for things that had nothing to do with work. Not loudly, not all at once, just enough to make it clear that survival, apparently, came with interest. By the time he noticed me, I had already learned how invisible a woman could become inside a company that ran on old friendships and unspoken hierarchies. It was a mid-sized firm, family-owned in everything but name, staffed almost entirely by people who looked like they had grown up together, married within the same circles, vacationed in the same places. I was Greek like them, white like them, but still not quite from them. My accent was softer. My background didn't align neatly with their stories. I was competent. That was never in question. I delivered clean work, met deadlines, solved problems without drama. But competence alone didn't buy protection. It just made you useful until you weren't. I watched men with half my output get buffered by relationships, while women like me floated closer and closer to the edge of replaceable. He was senior. Not the top, but close enough that people deferred to him without thinking. He had the kind of authority that didn't need to be announced. He spoke casually in meetings, interrupted without apology, and made decisions sound like favors. People laughed when he joked. They quieted when he didn't. Our early interactions were unremarkable. A nod in the hallway, a comment on a report, then small acknowledgments. He'd loop me into conversations I hadn't been part of before. Ask my opinion in front of others, say my name like it carried weight. I noticed how the room adjusted when he did that. I also noticed how precarious my position felt everywhere else. A project I'd been promised got reassigned without explanation. A performance review came back vague, padded with praise and thin on guarantees. HR smiled too much when I asked about growth. So when he invited me for a drink after work, it didn't feel romantic. It felt strategic. He framed it as mentorship, advice, a chance to talk openly without the noise of the office. I told myself it was harmless. I told myself I could handle a drink. That first night was careful. He talked about the company, about politics, about who mattered and who didn't. He said things I already knew but never heard spoken out loud. I felt seen in a way that wasn't flattering, just accurate. When he touched my arm, it wasn't sudden. It was placed there like punctuation. I remember thinking that this was how it started for a lot of women, not with desire, but with relief. Relief at finally having someone explain the rules. Relief at not pretending anymore. When I went home, I didn't feel excited. I felt braced, like I'd stepped onto a surface that might hold me or might collapse, and either way, I'd already committed my weight. The second time wasn't framed as a meeting. It was just understood. We didn't call it anything. That made it easier. No labels meant no consequences, at least on the surface. Sleeping with him felt transactional from the beginning, not cold, but contained. I paid attention to how he responded to me afterward, not during. The follow-up emails, the tone shifts, the access, that's where the real information lived. Things improved quickly. I was included, shielded. Mistakes that would have sunk me before were smoothed over. I could feel the difference in how people treated me without knowing why. They sensed alignment. They sensed protection. I told myself I had made a smart decision. I told myself I was using what I had in a system that never played fair anyway. I wasn't lying exactly. I just wasn't finishing the thought, because protection came with expectations, not immediately, not explicitly, just small recalibrations. He wanted more time, more availability. He didn't like when I took too long to respond. He asked questions about who I had lunch with, framed as curiosity. When I hesitated, his tone shifted, not angry, disappointed, like I was misunderstanding the arrangement. He started reminding me casually of how things used to be before he stepped in, how exposed I'd been, how vulnerable. The word gratitude entered the space without being spoken directly. It lived in implication, in pauses, in the way he'd help me and then wait just long enough to see if I noticed. I felt complicit and cornered at the same time. I had chosen this, but I hadn't chosen what it was becoming. The imbalance was obvious now. He wasn't risking anything. I was risking everything, my job, my reputation, my sense of myself. I started managing him the way I managed my work, anticipating moods, softening refusals, negotiating boundaries quietly, carefully. I hated how skilled I became at it. The hardest part wasn't the sex. It was the way he reframed it, the way he started talking like I owed him, like survival was something he had generously extended, not something I had clawed for. I could feel the contract forming, even though we never signed anything. And I knew contracts like that only ever tightened. The breaking point wasn't dramatic. It rarely is. It was a comment tossed off during a late conversation about how easily things could change, how quickly people forgot, how fragile positions were. I realized then that the shield I thought I'd built was also a leash, and I was the only one who could see it. Ending it wasn't clean. It was slow and defensive and full of strategic silence. I pulled back incrementally, pretending workload, stress, distance. He noticed. Of course he did. His responses became colder, less helpful, not overtly punitive, just absent. And absence in that place was dangerous. I felt the ground shift under me again. Project stalled, support thinned, nothing overt enough to accuse, nothing clean enough to confront, just erosion. Eventually, I left. Not in protest, not in victory. I left because staying meant accepting terms I couldn't live with anymore. I told people I was ready for something new. I let them believe it was ambition, not escape. What stayed with me wasn't shame exactly. It was clarity about how survival choices get recast as moral failures once the danger passes, about how systems reward silence and punish visibility, about how power rarely needs force when expectation does the job. I don't tell this story for absolution. I tell it because I know how easy it is to judge decisions made under pressure you've never felt. I know how quickly people rewrite cause and effect to protect the illusion of fairness. I slept with him to survive. What I didn't realize was how long survival would keep costing me, even after I walked away.